Hi, this is Tom Worman, former Hard Rock record producer, current Berkshire's innkeeper, and this is Focus on Metal.
Hey, Metalhead, Scott Thompson here, throwing out the big thank yous to you for once again tuning in to another episode of Focus on Metal. This week, our guest is Derek Davis, the vocalist behind Babylon AD. That's right, the same band that put out Bang Go the Bells way back in 1989. Derek is joining us this week as he's out there promoting their new album. Yes, that's right, I said new album. It's called Rome Wasn't Built in a Day. And these guys have actually been pretty busy over the last couple years. Back in like 2000, they released American Blitzkrieg, and then they were pretty quiet for a long ass time. But in 2017, they put out Revelation Highway. And then last year, they put out their third live album called Live Lightning. And, you know, this year, they have got, like I said before, Rome Wasn't Built in a Day. And I think somewhere in there as well, between 2000 and 2017, I think they put another live album out as well. Honestly, I did kind of lose track a bit as well, so that when Richie hit me up and said, hey, I've got a great interview that I just did with Derek Davis from Babylon AD, I was like, you mean that Babylon AD? So very cool to have them on. I think Babylon AD is another one of these bands that came in at the tail end of that huge push for this kind of style of metal in the mid to late 80s, and they just got that tail as well and ended up getting themselves cut short. Now, as you'll find out in the interview this week, there's a few things that they didn't really do themselves any favors as well. I gotta say, though, that they chose their own integrity over the label bullshit that was being thrown at them. Yep, they suffered, and you know, you'll hear about that. But again, I think kudos to them for sticking up for themselves, going as a band and saying, fuck that, we're not going to do what they want us to do. End of the day, giant suckbags for them. But nonetheless, hey, here it is, 2024, and they are still out there playing. Some of the original members, including Derek, still in the band. Both of the original guitar players are still in the band as well. So you still end up having that, as Derek talks about, the core Babylon AD sound and songwriting and all of that. So Richie really digs in this week with Derek. Lots of good stuff. Lots of good stories from Derek as well, including the first instance of the classic Clive Davis, Boys, I'm Gonna Make You Stars story here on Focus on Metal. And again, thank you for tuning in once again to another episode of Focus on Metal. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Richie and this week's guest, Derek Davis.
Not Derek.
Hey, Richie, how you doing, man?
I'm good. So, you're on the West Coast?
Yeah, I am.
Where are you, L.A.?
No, I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, you're in San Francisco. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I'll start off with the Whiskey Show. How did that go for you?
Oh, it was great, man. I love playing the Whiskey. You know, when you step on the stage at the Whiskey, you got to say to yourself, man, I'm standing where Jim Morrison stood, you know?
Yeah.
And the history of that club is just amazing that it's still around and it's the same stage and the same setup and everything, you know, you're visually and everything. It's the same, you know? And I don't know if that's the second time we played there this year. Well, we played there in September.
Okay.
We played there back in the day, quite a few, you know, times, you know, in the early 90s and stuff like that. But, I don't know, man. I just think the Whiskey is one of the best places to play in the world, you know, just because of the history, you know?
I remember going there, like, from Ireland, and over the years, you know, I'm living, like, in Ireland, so I'm in Europe, and I decided to travel to L.A. in the late 90s, and, you know, I think these places, that you swear when you go there, you're expecting, like, these places to be massive, and because they're iconic anyway,
yeah.
And I remember walking in there, and I'm going, is this the size of it? It's not that big at all.
No, I think maybe it holds about maybe 400 people or something, you know, but, you know, it's like, you know, I mean, how many places like that are left, you know? I mean, there's no club or, you know, there's no places that are history. And when they take that away, when they take that place away, there's not going to, I don't think there'll be a place in existence in, you know, for music, for rock and roll that's been around that has all that history, you know, if they ever tear it down, because they've been tearing down a lot of stuff on the strip lately. You know, they're tearing down the Viper Room, Johnny Depp's place.
Yeah.
They're tearing down a lot of shit, you know.
How easy is it to get a gig there? Because I'm assuming with a place like that, with the name it has, the waiting list is probably pretty long.
You know, it's funny, man. No matter what gig you ever get, it's almost always like who you know, or somebody knows somebody, or the booking agent is a close friend, or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
But it's always something like that. And this, I just reached out to the promoter, you know, the first show that we did in September. I just reached out to the promoter, and he hit me right back the very next day and said, hey, yeah, sure, you guys want to play? When do you want to play? He was already a fan of ours, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That makes it a lot easier. You know, he already, you know, was a fan of the band and knew everything about the band. He's like, oh, yeah, I'd love to have that one of you play. That's awesome, you know?
Yeah.
And we did play, I think, in 2016. We played there, too. So, and it's the same promoter. He's a really cool guy. His name's Jake Perry. He's a young guy, too, you know? So, it worked out.
I think it definitely helps when the promoter is a fan of your band. Because if he's not, he's not going to book you.
Oh, yeah. There have been times when, like, I'll hit up a club or something like that, or somebody will say, hey, call this guy, you know, he's a friend of the owners, you know, and they got a big club. And I'll say, oh, okay. And I'll check out the club and I'll go, yeah, that'd be a nice place to play. I'll hit him up and they'll go, well, I never heard of you before. You know, and then you're like, oh, I guess I'm back to square one.
there's horror stories out there now from, you know, a lot of the bands that were in the '80s, what they end up doing now is, they do a finite amount of shows every year, maybe fly-ins and stuff like that. And a lot of them are self-managed now. And I've interviewed enough of them now that some of them have told me that they've gotten stiffed after playing a show. Has that ever happened to you?
No, that's never happened. So, yeah, we have a contract for every single show. And our contract, I mean, we have a booking agent and everything like that, and we have a management team, and they book the shows. But at the same time, a lot of people call me, you know, because I am the kind of co-manager of the band. You know, I'm basically the spokesman, and a lot of people just call me or email me. But when they do, our contract states either we get, you know, just like a booking agent, 50% up front or 50% at the day of the show. Or if we've dealt with the club before, then it'll be right when we get to the show. You know, it could be 4 hours before we even play, but we don't do anything until we're there. And until we got that money in our hand before we hit the stage, you know, unless we're not hitting the stage, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I know there's been some stories over here over the years recently with some people booking festivals and some of the bands will arrive there and, you know, they don't get paid. There was one up here about, I think, 7 or 8 years ago. It was in New Hampshire. And I think it was Warrant and Lita Ford, and there was a bunch of them there. And none of them got paid.
Yeah, I remember that show. We played on something similar like that. Was that Hanover or something like that? Is that something there?
It might have been, yeah.
Yeah, I remember we played that show, and we heard a lot of people that got stiff, but we didn't. We didn't get stiff.
Yeah.
But I heard that, and we played a show over in Europe about maybe, I don't know, 4 years ago or so, and the same thing. We got paid, you know, but we heard there was a lot of bands that didn't get paid and got stiff.
Okay.
We just got luck of the draw, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's the issue. Like, if you're traveling that far, it's a major headache, because you might have to do something with the flights and everything, and then your visas, and, you know, there's a lot on. You guys just don't show up at a gig and play. Like, there's a lot involved before you even get on the plane.
Oh, all the people don't know about. It's such, you know, to be honest with you, man, you're up on stage for maybe an hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes, but the work goes into that, you know, not just the practice. It's you like to practice and things like that, but all the work that goes into scheduling your flights, bringing your merchandise, you know, dealing with the club owners, dealing with everything you have to deal with. There's a lot that goes into a show that people don't see, you know, especially when bands are doing it themselves that just don't have like a management team that, you know, this is what you do and you stand here and you do that, you know.
Mm,
that's
mm.
sometimes when you got somebody doing everything for you, you know.
Yeah. So Derek, I got one more question for you about the whiskey. Was there a band or an act that you saw there over the years that you still look back and say, "Wow, I can't believe I saw this band there," like Van Halen or someone like that?
I saw the Pretenders there one time and I was blown away. I was like, "What the heck?" And I think I was so blown away because like people like Tom Jones and Rod Stewart were there, you know, and it was like a who's who of movie stars and Hollywood people, you know, and somehow me and my manager, you know, got invited. You know, I think he was best friends with the photographer or something. And I was just like looking around the room going, wow, this is crazy, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So I just want to ask about the new record, Rome Wasn't Built in a Day. Where does the motivation come from now to write new material? Like, does it come from a different place now because it's so the industry is so different than what it used to be?
I don't know if it really comes from a different place. I mean, I'm always writing, you know. I've got a recording studio at my house, so I do a lot of demos, and then I do a lot of, you know, I finish up the record here, basically, you know. But I do a lot of writing on my own, and I also write with the guys in the band, you know, and I take their ideas and I kind of form them. They might have like a really cool guitar riff, you know, like, wow, I wish I would have wrote that guitar riff, and then I'll make it into a song, you know, kind of a... you know, put a bridge to it or whatever. Basically, yeah, I'm just making it into a song, you know, a guitar riff. So I don't know. You know, for some reason, I'm still inspired. I kind of think that I still have something to say. Yeah. You know, I wish I had more time, to be honest with you, to be in the studio, you know, 100 hours a day, you know, but I'm limited to about 8 months out of the year, I'm in the studio pretty much all the time. And then the other time I'm just doing other things that have nothing to do with music, you know, traveling or what you're playing or just something that doesn't have to do with recording. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. I like recording and writing, you know, a lot.
I think, yeah, because I think I'm doing the show, this my 13th year doing it. And I've spoken to the same musicians multiple times over those years. And sometimes you get a sense that the enthusiasm to write new music is waning because their take on it is who's going to buy it, who's going to play it. And I get where they're coming from, you know. And then you have someone like Gene Simmons just saying, you know, well, rock is dead when it comes to new bands and all that. And now I'm a big proponent of bands bringing out new music, but I do get where they're coming from. It's like, I'm going to spend all this time and effort writing all this new music, and what am I going to get out of it?
Yeah. Sometimes you think like that, you know, every once in a while it'll hit me like that. Like, man, I'm really not making any money out of this. You know, what's the point? But then I say, well, it's not really about the money anyways. To me, it's about the art, you know. I see every single song that I write as a piece of art. You know, that's the way I see it. I don't see it as a vehicle to make a lot of money and, wow, look at me, I'm rich now, I wrote a hit song. Although I'd like to, you know, I'd like to write a hit song and make money, but that's not why I'm in it. You know, I'm in it to satisfy my soul, you know, and to say things that I can't necessarily convey in just regular speech with people, you know what I mean? Perhaps I've got kind of depressed and have said the same exact thing, like, what is the point? My wife has heard me say that many times. Next day I'm in my studio saying, who gives a shit what the point is? I like it, you know?
Okay. Are you a perfectionist then?
I let a lot of stuff go that I think, I mean, because I listen to a lot of old stuff. When I say old, like old recordings like Bob Dylan, Simon and Garfunkel, and, you know, but then I'll listen to like Al Green, Marvin Gaye, James Brown. There's mistakes in that stuff all over the place if you really listen to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So sometimes I don't like to sanitize stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a cut and paste kind of guy. I know there's a lot of people. Matter of fact, most bands do it now. Producers, they cut and paste everything. You know, hey, that's a good chorus. Let's just cut it and paste it over here. You know, that kind of thing. You know, I don't do that. I don't like that. I like to, every time I sing a chorus, even if it's the same exact line as I just sang previously at the beginning of the song, I'm going to sing this. Maybe I'll sing it. Try to sing it the same, but it's going to be a little bit different if you really listen. You know, my intonation on my vocal cords or something like that might be scratchier, or I might go up instead of down, that kind of thing, you know. And even with guitar stuff, you know, there's no cut and paste and things like that when I'm producing anyways. You know, I know a lot of cats, you know, they think it's faster and all that kind of stuff. and it probably is, but I just think it takes the realism away, you know?
Mm. So who's the soundboard for you when you're doing vocals to say whether it's good enough or not? Is there someone that you can rely on to say, what do you think? Or do you more or less know now?
I kind of know. To be honest with you, I kind of know. But I still, as soon as the song is done, there's a few people that will play it for maybe 5 or 6 different people. And they're all close to me and people that have heard my music since I was 15 years old.
Yeah.
So they tell me right off the bat, like, I don't know, Derek, you're kind of singing weird here or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I'll maybe explain, well, I was trying to do this. Well, you're not really doing it like that, man. You know, they'll say something like that. And then I'll go back to the drawing board and maybe sing either the whole song over or that part over. It doesn't happen too often. I'm pretty confident when I lay down because I'm pretty, you know, when I'm singing and recording my vocals, I'm pretty particular what I'm trying to do. You know what I mean? But like I said, there's a few people that they tell me flat, straight up, you know what I mean? This isn't working or whatever, you know, or it's a good song, but your melody is way off. What are you thinking? That kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Mm. So do you think that the best songs for you were written quickly? Because I know this record took a while to get done.
I know this record took a while to get done, but that's really just because life kind of gets in the way. I mean, I did in between our last album, which was released in late 2017, I think November 17, I wrote a blues album and I wrote a soul album and I, you know, recorded those, you know?
Yeah.
And I had another soul band, like a soul funk band, and we recorded about 6 or 7 songs that nobody's ever heard. It's like a Sly and the Family Stone type of thing, man. It's really, really super cool. And I keep wanting to put it out, saying, man, I got to put this out, man. This stuff's really cool. It's like the Barclays meets Sly Stone over at Terrence Trent D'Arby's house or something. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's different, you know, and I don't know how people would think, like, oh, who does he think he is, you know, trying to be a soul singer or whatever. But that's really kind of like where my heart has always been, you know. I love soul, man. Old school soul, you know. And that's how I cut my chops coming up. Although the hard rock guys that I tried to emulate were like Steven Tyler and Sammy Hagar, and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Wow,
and,
the cream of the crop.
Yeah, that's what I mean. 14 years old, trying to sing Back on the Saddle, and my voice is, you know, determined, man. I'll go Back in the Saddle, yeah. You know what I mean? For probably a year, man. Mm. You know, listen to a lot of Steve Marriott, you know, and stuff like that. And so I got some of that grit. You know, sometimes I'll take it away, but I can get it when I want to. You know, that kind of thing. A lot of people say, sometimes I'll do like Rod Stewart just for fun at shows, like when I do a solo thing, and I'll be 2 or 3 Rod Stewart songs, and people will go, holy shit, why aren't you putting this out? You know, just do Maggie May, Derek Davis, Maggie May. You sing better than Rod. I'm like, no, nobody sings better than Rod Stewart, dude. You know what I mean? But I copy pretty good, you know?
Yeah. So, Derek, is it easy to get into the headspace to do a Babylon AD record? And here's where I'm coming from with that question. You said you're doing all these other different types of music, right? Your band had a sound that was predominantly came out from the late 80s, early 90s when you're on a major label. So you're known for that sound, but you're not the same person. All of the band members aren't the same people. And you're trying to make an album that is trying to sound like that. Is that easy to get?
I don't think it's easy to get, except for the fact that the two guitar players, John Matthews, was in the band when we got our record contract, and he's been in the band again since 2016. It's a long story, but him and Danny De La Rosa, the other guitar player, were great friends, and Danny wanted to leave because he wanted to do a solo album, and then John jumped back in the band, and John was the original guitar player, and Ron has been with the band the whole time.
Yeah.
So when you got guitar players that play, basically, I mean, I swear to God, I could play you tapes of those guys like when they were 15, when we first started, and it sounds like the same damn guitar tone, same guitar licks and everything, you know what I mean? Ron sort of just has his style of writing, you know, it's like that Bango the Bells kind of riffs and things like that, and John has his guitar style of writing, and then I always wrote, even though the first couple albums, you know, I wrote my own songs too, but they, you know, they meshed in with that, you know? The same thing with this album. I think I wrote 4 songs on this album. But with their guitar playing, You know, it sounds like Babylon AD. And to be honest with you, I did listen to the first album quite a bit as I was starting to mix this album. Even before I mixed it, I listened to drone tones a lot and things like that. Because I said to myself, you know, we got a lot of people are looking for that first Babylon AD sound, you know?
Yeah.
So I really did a lot of A-Bing with a lot of different types of bands that were out at the same time, trying to figure out what made us a little bit different. And I kind of discovered that we sounded a little bit heavier, more weightier on the bottom end, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of fatter, I guess, would be the only way. EQ-wise, it sounded just bigger, you know? So I tried to capture that on this album. You know, it's not small and tight and, you know, compressed. You know, I didn't use hardly that much compression at all. I mean, I just kind of tried to capture it natural, but I tried to, as best I could, capture what we sounded like 30 years ago. Which I think we got pretty close.
You did, definitely. You know, I mean, but Derek, yeah. I want to ask about, you know, you got 11 songs, I believe, on the record, right? But you wrote more than that. I'm just curious to know, are any of the songs that weren't included on the record, were any of them really left field where you went, no, that's too far off the beaten track for Babylon AD fans to get this?
Well, yes. There was one song that I swear everybody that heard it, all the people, well, we have like a bunch of people that are, you know, good friends of ours or our wives. It's just people that we trust. And, you know, in our management, they're all like, oh, man, this song is a hit song. But then we kept getting like, but it's not a Babylon AD song. And like, how could you make it a Babylon AD song? You know, because it starts off with piano and things like that. You know what I mean? It's called You've Got to Believe, you know? So our management team was like, well, maybe we could release it as a single in between the next album, you know, and just really trip people out, you know? And for me, it was like, yeah, I know what you mean, you know, because it's a great song, man. It's just got, it's hooked to the max, you know, but there's not like a lot of leads in it, things like that. It's a radio song, you know what I mean? It's big and fat. It's almost like an Elton John kind of song with a lot of piano going in it, you know. But yeah, so we had a few of those that were pretty much off the beaten track. That's just one that I could think of that everybody said, I think this is a hit, you know, that kind of thing. But what is a hit nowadays? Who knows, you know what I mean?
True. And you probably tried to write them before and you think, yeah, that's a hit, and it went nowhere. It just comes.
Before you were trying to do that, and now you're just like, fuck it, I'm just going to write whatever I want.
Exactly. Exactly. So how has your voice changed over the years? Has it gotten a little bit raspier, a little bit lower?
Yeah, it's got a lot raspier. I just have more control of it, you know, than I did then. I mean, I was young, man, when we made the first couple albums, and I just, you know, I thought I had my voice, but at the same time, over the years, I've just listened to so much more stuff. And like I said, I jumped into the blues and I listened to like a lot of Elmore James and Sun House and, you know, Muddy Waters and stuff like that. And for a while I was really trying to sing really gritty like that, you know, yeah, I'm living that baby. You know what I mean? And then pretty soon I'm listening to James Brown and I'm doing all his screams and ow and all that crap. You know what I mean? So as time goes by, it kind of like that little stuff kind of seeps its way into your vocals, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think you could probably hear it on like a wrecking machine or something. You could hear the grit, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
But sometimes I'll lay off on that and I'll just say, no, this song doesn't really call for that. I got to kind of just, you know, do a John Waite kind of thing, you know, more like the Babies or something, you know, and Harry, you know?
What's interesting for me talking to singers is a lot of them, they prefer their voice now, but the issue they have is that the records that they made years ago, they all say the same thing to me. I sang them so damn high that it's really hard to get there now. Some can do it and some can't. But a lot of them have told me that you might say I was a better singer back then, but I actually prefer my voice now.
Yeah, I know exactly what they're talking about. I mean, luckily for me, I'm able to pull it off, you know, but there's a couple songs like I don't even touch anymore. Like there's one on the second album called Sacrifice Your Love. To be honest with you, it was tough back then trying to sing that song because it's so hot. And it was really, I was struggling back then, but now it's like, man, I don't even want to try to struggle and get on stage and, you know, I might hit a wrong note or have to sing it lower and then I'd be, you know, feel like a jerk, you know. I like to sing this, you know, the way I sang them back then, you know. If I'm going to sing Bang of the Bells, you know, I might put a little oomph in there, a little something different, but I'm going to sing the exact same melody and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm not going to try to drop down a little bit, or I don't have, I know some bands are doing that now. I mean, I know some. I know a few guys that are in some pretty big bands, and I know one band that dropped two keys. I'm like, holy smokes, man! You know, I don't even know if my voice could drop two keys. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess some of the fans don't notice it. Maybe I don't know. You know, I notice it. That, you know, being a musician, but you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
You know,
Derek, I'm always fascinated with singers, and I've asked this question to lots of them. What's the sickest you've ever been and still been able to do the show?
Oh, man. One time we were playing this place in North Carolina. It was like an army base, man. The place was packed. And I got to tell you, man, I was so sick for like probably 3 days. And we played two nights in a row. I was literally throwing up on stage like every 15 minutes on the side of the stage. I had a fever. I was just so sick, man. I don't know how I even pulled it off. I think we played maybe 40 minutes instead of like an hour and 15, you know what I mean? But literally, I didn't think I was going to be able to do it, but I guess there was so much money involved. You can't just do it. You know, you got to do it. People have done it before, and here I was just almost throwing up in my mic half the time, you know? So it was horrible, I got to tell you. I remember that, you know.
Yeah.
Behind stuff, you know, throwing up and then going out and singing, you know. Horrible.
I want to ask about the record you did for Frontiers.
Yeah.
And I've read interviews where you've talked about what happens after the record has come out as regards marketing and stuff like that. And I've interviewed a ton of musicians on Frontiers, so I know the story. But with you, the question I want to ask is, before the record came out, how involved were the label in what sound they wanted from you? Because some musicians I've talked to, Frontiers don't say anything to them when it comes to the sound of the record. And others, the label has gone to them and said, I want this album to sound like that record. What were they like with you on that?
Yeah, they did not say one peep, because our record was already done. It was done, and we weren't shopping it or anything. We just let people know we're putting out a record in a couple months. You know, get ready, you know, that kind of thing, like in a few press releases and stuff. And we didn't know exactly how we were going to put it out, but we knew we were going to put it out, and it was basically done, you know, about 99% of it. And then somehow somebody at Frontiers Record heard about that, and they called me up. So we had a long discussion, and after that we had, you know, email after email after email after email and things like that. And then pretty soon a contract was drawn, and yeah, so they had no input at all. The only input they had was like what was going to be the single, you know, first single or second single. And then we, you know, kind of went round and round on that, what we thought would be the first single, what they thought would be the first single, that kind of thing. And they're overseas, you know, so
yeah,
we're an American band in California, you know, so, but that's where everybody gravitated to, you know, a few years ago was Frontiers. And I could see why, you know. I mean, when you look at the roster, who they've had in the past and everything, you're going, wow, you know, and Y&T's been on there, and shoot, I think Rick Springfield and Journey and everybody, you know, so it's like, wow, man, they're like the last of the hard rock labels that there's left, you know, we got to go with those guys, you know, that's was our perspective anyways, you know.
Derek, being someone, you're from San Francisco, right?
Uh-huh.
So someone from San Francisco, what influence did Y&T and Dave Menichetti have on you?
Major. Everybody in the band, I got to tell you, to be honest with you, you know, and I've never told Dave this. I think I told his wife one time about it, you know, because we played with Y&T about maybe 7 or 8 times about 4 or 5 years ago. And I was in high school. I was a freshman, you know, and I just started playing guitar and everything, you know. And of course, I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to be a rock star or that kind of thing. In my head, this is what I was thinking, but I was still learning G and D and B, you know what I mean, chords and things like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Y&T came to our school, came to our high school, and their album had just came out, and they played at lunchtime. And, man, they fucking smoked, man.
Which album was it, Derek? Can you remember?
The first album.
Earthshaker?
Yeah, Earthshaker.
Oh, man. Wow.
Yeah. And Leonard was on, I mean, right then and there, man, I was practicing probably 3 hours a day. I started practicing 8 hours a day after that. I was like, I want to be like that dude. I want to be so bad, man. And they're, you know, it's kind of funny because they're from Hayward, and I'm from Hayward. You know, they went to Tennyson. I went to Sunset, like rival schools, you know. But they're all, of course, they're, you know, 7, 8, 10 years, whatever it is, 10 years older than us, I guess, you know. But, you know, they were like our heroes, man. And they had their flyers up all over town all the time, you know, on telephone posts every time they play a show, even before they had a gig, you know. A record deal on, I think it was on London. And, man, they were on fire. And they still are on fire. I mean, Dave is still kicking ass. I mean, I go see them probably 3 times a year. And, you know, it's amazing, man. I mean, that cat has really put, you know, part of Northern California on the radar, you know. But I think he's very, very underrated.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't think enough people really pay attention to what he's doing because, man, he's bluesy and he's soulful. And when he plays that guitar, man, you could feel it. You could stand on the near the stage and kind of like feel the notes kind of like grind into you. And I don't know how he does it, really. I mean, because I've got guitar players I play, but their notes aren't grinding in my gut when they hit them, you know what I mean?
He played on My Way about 3 years ago. And the tour they were doing one song from every record, at least one song.
Yeah.
And they played for about 2.5 hours. And I think there was like a 2 or 3 minute drum solo. And other than that, he was on stage for the whole show.
And sang,
played guitar, and then came and met everyone after the show. And I remember watching him and I'm thinking, this dude is 70. And he's still a fabulous singer and guitar player. Like, you know, you don't get these guys that can do both. And he's one of them.
And him and Jill, they got such a good team. They're like they're a machine, man. They're a YNT machine. They've kept that thing going all these years. You know, he's the only original member, but it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just crazy. Like John, so for instance, like John Nyman, the rhythm guitar player in the band.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know anything about John Nyman, but he went to school with Dave. You know, he was in 415, and he played with Eric Martin band and things like that, you know. So John Nyman's always been a staple of the Bay Area too. So these guys have always kind of like been like our heroes. Like, we want to be like those guys, you know, when we were growing up, you know.
Mm. Do you have any memories of, you know, of course, what San Francisco is known as well from my point of view is, you know, you had Death Angel and you had Testament and Metallica, you would have been around for all of that as well. What are your memories of that growing up?
You know, it's funny because like Testament, Death Angel was more like by San Francisco. We used to play with them quite a lot, you know, even before they had a record deal. I think they might have got a deal before us, but we were playing around the same type of clubs and things like that. When I was in other bands, I was in a band called Audio that was pretty popular, and we almost had a record deal. We got a couple singles out, things like that. And then I was in another band called Candy. So this was before Babylon AD. So I was playing in a lot of bands at the same time those guys were. But I remember like Testament and Metallica and stuff. Man, we just go to backyard parties, man. They'd be playing in Livermore right down the street from my house, you know. They were just high school parties. And everybody was just jamming, you know, and wailing. And then I remember when Metallica put out their first album, we were all so blown away because we're all around the same age, you know, and we're all in high school, coming out of high school, and we're all like, how the hell did you guys do this? And they're like, wow, man, we got some money together. It was like they didn't have no barriers in their minds. And to us, it was like, oh, you can't make your own record. That costs too much money. And they're like, no, man, we got like a $5,000 loan, and we did this, and we did that. And we're like, really? That's what you did? You know? There was a band called Laws Rocket that did the same thing.
Yeah, I remember them. Focus.
Yeah, you know, I kind of wish I would have did that, but I didn't have the balls to, like, you know, say, fuck it, I'm going to go for it and make my own record, you know? And I remember when we played with Motley Crue when they first made their first record, and they did the same damn thing. You know, just put their money, got some money from their parents or something, and said, screw it, we'll make our own record, you know?
So when I look back now and I look at all these, you know, the concert posters and places that were in that area, and there's the Stone, I think, was one, the Omni was another, I think, I can't remember one or two more, but when you look at the magazine advertisements, you'd see the same band 3 nights, one place to the other, and you could go see all 3 shows.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at the list of bands in these places, and I'm talking like even in the 90s, and I'm thinking, fucking hell, like you guys probably played there. King's X, Mr. Big, fucking, you know.
All those clubs.
Michael Schenker. I'm like, wow. Yep. I'm like, I could have seen Michael Schenker three nights in the same area.
Yeah, well, you'd have the Stone in San Francisco, then you had the Keystone Palo Alto, then you had the Keystone Berkeley, then you had the Omni, and then you had the Cabaret in San Jose, and then you had another place called Nile Station. You had about six really good places to play that were just in the Bay Area, and wow, any night, somebody really good. You know what I mean? We used to play that circuit all the time, you know, before we got a record deal. We were staples on there too. But you're right, you can see all those bands. We got King's X, Michael Schenker, whoever you want to see. You know, Eric Martin band, didn't matter, Y&T, you know. I mean, all these clubs were pretty damn big clubs. You know, they weren't like a bar where there's, you know, they were twice the size of, three times the size of the Whiskey. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
Large clubs, you know. And they were, man, there were rock clubs. John Nady owned a couple of them. And this guy named Bob Corona owned all the Stones, you know, that's Keystone Berkeley, Keystone Palo Alto, and the Stone in San Francisco. So if you got to know Big Bob, then it was like, okay, hey, can we play, Bob? You know, play, oh yeah, what night you want to play, man? You know, it was one of those kind of things. You know what I mean?
It seems to me, and it's coming across with you as well, that there was great camaraderie there amongst the bands. I there was competition for sure, but
yeah,
every band wanted all the other bands to do well.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, you know, everybody talks about like the Nirvana explosion, you know, the whole thing that happened in Seattle, you know what I mean? But really, I would say about 85 to about 89, there was an explosion over here in San Francisco that was going on. You know what I mean? 84 maybe, you know, when like you said, like with Death Angel and Metallica and, you know, just Y&T, you know, didn't matter. I mean, there was a lot of big bands that came out of this area, you know, for a good 4 or 5 years, you know. There was a band called The Flame that got a deal after us, and I think Vane got a deal after us. But I think we were like the last of the San Francisco bands that got a record deal, you know.
Mm. Can I ask you a little bit about getting signed with Arista? I'm always fascinated by showcase gigs where guys will come to a studio or you'll play to an empty hall. Did that happen to you?
Absolutely. Yeah, it happened. The first time Clive Davis came down and seen us, you know, it was in San Francisco at SIR Studios, and the A&R guy at Arista Records, his name is Randy Gersten, and he felt that we were ready to get signed. So Clive Davis said, I want you guys basically Clive at Arista, you don't get signed unless he said you get signed. You know, an A&R guy that doesn't sign you, Clive Davis signed you. So he's seen us in San Francisco at a showcase in San Francisco at SIR Studios, and it was just him, two guys on a couch, and our manager. That was it. You know, and we're on a big giant stage with the lights going and everything, and just like we're, you know, at a concert. And we were green, man. We'd only been together, I think, 8 months. You know, and that's what he said. He took me aside. He goes, Derek, I like your voice. I think you guys got something, and you kind of remind me of, you know, the first time I ever seen Aerosmith. You know, I get that same vibe from you, but I just think you're too green. You're not ready yet. I want you to keep on working with our A&R guy and everything, and just do what he says, and make more demos and make more songs. And then, you know, if everything looks good, maybe I'll come see you, you know, in another year or something when you're ready. And we were bummed out, of course. We were like, ah, shit, man, you know, that's it for us, you know.
Hmm.
But we just kept on pounding and grinding, man, and we kept playing more and more shows. And what is the weirdest thing, man, still blows my mind how this happened. So our manager goes, look, man, you guys have played everywhere in the San Francisco Bay Area for like 2 years now. You know, there's nowhere else to conquer. There's nothing else to do, you know. We've got a few record labels that are, you know, pitching money at you guys for demos, $15,000 here, $15,000 there, but for demos. But I know if you come down to L.A. and play a couple shows, Arista will take, you know, get back into your interest in you. Maybe Clive will come out and see you. So we all moved down to L.A. in a one-bedroom apartment called St. James, and it was right down the street on Hollywood Boulevard. And I mean, it was mayhem, man, every night. I mean, the guys in Guns N' Roses, not Axl, but a couple guys lived there. Charlie Sheen lived there. It was like crazy. It was a crazy like existence that we were already crazy, but now we were in Hollywood, man, right down the street, and this place was called the St. James Apartment Building. You know, Extreme lived there. I mean, it seemed like everybody lived there that was getting a deal or wanting to get a deal, or a movie star that was
When are we talking? Are we talking before Appetite for Destruction or 88?
So we're talking about the same exact time as Appetite for Destruction. Their album came out, but we shared a studio with Guns N' Roses for about 3 or 4 months when we first moved down there. But let me get to back to my point I was trying to make about Clive Davis. So we were literally there. We got there on a Thursday or a Friday. He called the very next day, our manager, and said, I want to see the guys tomorrow at this studio at this time. I'm going to be in L.A. And we were like, holy shit. But we didn't practice. You know, we hadn't practiced for 2 or 3 weeks. We didn't know what we were going to friggin' do. You know what I mean? But we put together a quick set, about 8 songs. And we went to SIR Studio, just like we basically were told. And now it's our second audition for Clive Davis. So this time we played, I think it was 8 songs, and same thing. He brought out 2 guys from New York, and there was an A&R guy from LA and our management team. And right when we got done, man, he just jumped off this couch, man, like out of a movie. You see, out of a movie or something. He just jumps off this frigging couch and he goes, "Welcome to the family, boys." Yeah, that's what he said. And he opened up his arms, you know, and we all looked at each other like, I mean, we just hit the last chord, like, dank, you know what I mean? And we went, does this mean we got a record deal? He goes, of course it means you got a record deal. You guys, I'm going to make you bigger than Aerosmith and all this shit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, oh, God, we went out and partied so much. We probably partied for a week, man, at the Rainbow and the Whiskey and the Roxy. And we had a record deal, man. We thought we were like the kings of the fucking world, you know what I mean?
Mm.
But yeah, so that's how it happened. It was literally like we moved down to LA and bam, we get a record deal like 2 days later, you know. And then of course,
how green were you, Derek, when it came to the business side of music? Because you've been handed this major label deal, right? You're probably thinking, right, I'm made. I'm going to have a shit ton of money now. And then later on, you find out that, you know, certain things happen in the music business where these guys get a cut and these guys get a cut, and they want you to make music like this and not like that.
Yeah, exactly, man. You hit it right on the head. Nail on the head right there, man. Yeah, we were all green. We didn't know what the frick we were doing. I mean, we got a 10-album deal. You know, we're like, oh, we're set for life, man. We're going to be like Fleetwood Mac. You know, we didn't know. A couple albums, if you do good, we'll do another couple albums kind of thing, you know, like a tiered type of thing. You know, we just all we knew was we got millions of dollars for a 10 album deal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what we seen. It was like a dream. You know what I mean? But little did we know that we're just basically borrowing from the bank, you know, and the bank is promoting you. That's, you know, and pretty soon as about 6 months, 8 months go by after your record first comes out, even when you're in the recording studio, you didn't know that was all your money. You know, we're renting gear for like $480 a day. You know, we didn't know it was really coming out of our money. We just thought it was coming out of the record company's money. You know what I mean?
Derek, when did you start asking questions? And how did they take it when you did start asking questions?
Started asking questions when our accountant actually sued us because we fired him. We fired him because a guy was coming to every show we did and all he'd do is hit on chicks. And he was like this slick car salesman guy with gold chains and everything, and you know, it was just obvious that this guy was just like out of his element and just some bullshitter guy. And we got to get rid of this guy, man. I think his name is Richard Brookbush. I'll never forget that guy. And then he sued us, saying that I should be making, you know, he should be making like $2 million a year from us and all this shit. We're like, what the fuck is he talking about? We have to get a lawyer, and the lawyer costs all this money. So now we're entangled up in court and doing all this shit. We're like, this is insane. And I'm just thinking, I just want to grab that motherfucker and beat the shit out of him. You know what I mean?
And all you want to do is write songs and play music.
Yeah. And you know, so that was the first go around. So the second go around, which is even crazier, is 2 years go by as we're still going to court with this guy. Still going to court with this guy. And our lawyer who said he can handle the whole thing for like $20,000, don't worry about it, blah, 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 I'll make just go away. Well, I guess he spent the $20,000, and then he looks at me because I get the, you know, the bulk of the publishing money for the songwriting, you know, and he calls up my manager and he says, I need to see Derek and you right now in my office, or, you know, tomorrow, whatever. And so we go down there, and this guy's basically shaking me down. Our own lawyer, he has all these boxes on this wall, and he says, you see those boxes, Derek? And I go, yeah. And he goes, those are all your boxes from the court case. I look at the wall, and it's like stacked to the ceiling for this one dude, man, you know. And this guy tried to shake me down, saying that I want you to pay me $10,000 to keep the case going and everything. Man, I jumped out of my seat. I almost threw that motherfucker out the window. I think we're on the fourth floor. I grabbed him by the collar, slapped him a couple of times. I threw a penny at him, hit him in the head. And my manager was freaking out and going, well, you can't do that. What do you know? I was like, fuck you, man. I'm from fucking Oakland, California. I'll do whatever the hell I want. Guy ain't shaking me down. I'll beat his fucking ass, you know?
See, anyways, it's stories like this where I'm on the outside looking in, and I'm wondering, how do you still keep the enthusiasm for the business? You know, you're young and you've all these dreams and, you know,
yeah.
See, the easy thing for me to ask you would be, you know, did grunge kill your band? And for a lot of people, it isn't. It's a lot more than that. And what I'm getting from you is it's a lot more than that. But you still want to make music, you know, and sometimes that blows me away.
Well, you know, so to be honest with you, so then, you know, we maybe 6 months later, 8 months later, a year later, we lose our record deal anyways, and everybody in the band moved back to the Bay Area. So it was like a 5-year whirlwind of living in Los Angeles and just living the dream of what you thought a rock star was, being on the bus, you know, just partying every night, just going crazy, you know, that kind of thing. And now we're back home, but everybody kind of went back home with their tails between their legs, you know?
Yeah.
We didn't want to be in the business. I wanted to play music, but it was like, I was at, remember how you were saying earlier, like, what's the point thing? That's where I was at. I was like, what's the point, man? Somebody's going to rip up my music anyways, or they're going to make a way for them to make money, and I don't make no money. You know, I was really at that point. So there was probably a good 7 years, man, where I wrote songs sometimes, and I played guitar and acoustic and things like that. And then, you know, I really just, man, just struggling to find who the frick I was after that. You know, I'd say there was a good 7 years. Because that's from probably 93 to about 99 when we put out our next album. Mm. It took that long for everybody in the band to kind of like come to grips with, wow, what did we just go through, man? You know what I mean?
Did any of you guys fall out with each other?
I don't know if falling out would be the word. No, I don't know. We've all known each other since we were like in high school, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody went to, you know, three guys went to this high school, two guys went to this high school, but we were all in rival bands, even though we're, you know, everybody knew who each other were. We were in the same area, small pocket of about a 15, 20 mile range. You know what I mean? And so, no, there's not really no falling out. I mean, my drummer, Jamie, he quit like about 3 years ago, and I asked him if he wanted this record, and he said no. So, I mean, that's falling out you can be, you know, is like he didn't want to play on the record. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It was his own thing. So I've known him since he was 15 years old. So I'm not going to say, you know, you got to play on my record. It was just like, well, you don't want to play on the record? All right, fuck it. I'll find another drummer then. That kind of thing. You know what I mean? Because I want to go on, you know?
Yeah. Can I ask you for a minute about Tom Werman? I interviewed him years ago. And I read his book that came out, I think it was late last year, I think it came out. And I know he produced one of your records. And what was your experience working with him? Like, what did you learn from him?
Man, I think I should read his book and see what he says. The one thing I learned about Tom is, I don't think Tom's a musician at all, but he's a good manager. You know, manager of time, manager of watching the board, watching the clock. But Tom, you know, he had so many stories, man. It was like talking to an encyclopedia of music, you know. And the funniest thing is we wanted him to produce our first album, and we couldn't get him, you know. He was preoccupied with other bands. Motley Crue, I think, was Girls, Girls, Girls or something like that, or, you know, whatever. But we waited for him to do our second album. And the reason we waited for him, because when I was in high school, I would always look and see who the producer was. I'd be like, oh, Well, Ted Nugent, you know, Tom, you know, Cheap Trick, The Babies, whatever. It seemed like everybody that the bands that I liked were produced by Tom Werman. So as I got older, I was like, man, we're going to have Tom Werman produce our record. We got to have Tom Werman produce our record. You know what I mean? So by the time Tom Werman produces our record, you know, he produced a lot of major, major bands. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Tom was just, man, I don't know. He's a crazy dude, man. Funny, crazy guy. You know, we used to call, I mean, we had our inside jokes. We call him Coconut Tom. You know, I don't know what he said in his book, but did he say anything about it Friday nights?
No, you guys weren't really mentioned in depth in the book. You're mentioned in it, but he doesn't really go into detail about the record.
But does he say anything about what he does on Friday nights?
There's certain things he goes into that he did and he doesn't do anymore. put it that way. Like the bands weren't the only ones partying; he was partying with them.
And actually, sometimes. I'd say half the time he was the leader. He was. So we used to call him Coconut Tom, and he'd get pissed off because he'd have some masseuse come down every Friday night. Like, we stopped recording at 6 o'clock. All right, time to stop recording. You know, and he'd go in the room, whatever, the studio that was at. I don't even know if I should be telling this story, man. This is fucked up, but I mean, it's only rock and roll. But
yeah,
he smelled. Come out, smell like coconuts. With some shorts on. Like some real short shorts. I mean, almost like, you know, you're going to go to the beach in Italy. And we'd laugh our ass off at him. And he'd be all pissed off. Fuck you guys, man.
You know? all work and no play.
Yeah. And sometimes he'd say to us, and we were party fucking animals. And he'd go, what's wrong with you guys, man? You guys don't party enough. We'd look at each other like, what? The only thing we're not doing is fucking big old lines of cocaine in front of you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what were the
bands or the artists he produced that I have to ask him about this guy? Was Ted Nugent must have been one of them? Obviously, Cheap Trick. What, Motley Crue?
Yeah. And Motley Crue, Girls. And he did a band that we really liked. A lot of people have never heard of this band, but did you remember a band called The Producers?
I do not.
Yeah, they're from Chicago. You should check out one of their albums, man. It's very poppy, but fucking badass songs. I mean, the first time you hear them, like, she lives in my mind. They got, you know, their vocal and the songwriting was almost like, I don't want to say the Beatles, but that's as close as I could think of, because you got two-part harmony going through almost every single song. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He produced. So they were... They were an underrated band, I felt. You know, I don't know if he mentioned them in the book, and he probably did, but
there's so many bands he did. I can't remember all of them.
I think he did three other albums, though, because he really loved those guys. They were a really good band, man. They had a song called, if you remember, MTV at the time, What's He Got dun, dun, That I Ain't Got dun, 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 dun. He's Got You. That's what he's got. Do you remember that song at all?
I don't.
It was kind of like New Wave, but it wasn't New Wave. You know, it had a hard rock kind of poppy bite to it. Anyways, you know, and of course he did Girls, more importantly, he did the bands that I loved when I was a kid. Like I said, like Cheap Trick, Babies, freaking, I don't think he did Aerosmith, but, you know, Ted Nugent, you know. So Tom was, man, a force. I mean, He was a really cool dude, but he was really funny and temperamental. Man, when he turned Friday night, it was Coconut Tom.
Did he? How involved was he in maybe getting changing the arrangements on some of the songs?
Not at all.
Not at all. Okay.
Not at all. Yeah. So that was what's weird about Tom, because so on our first album, we had Simon Hanhart produce us, and Simon came from like the Def Leppard school of thought of producing, because I guess he was an engineer on a couple of albums. You know, he did Saxon and I think UFO and things like that. But he was really, really, really strict, right? So when we started, before we got in the studio, he wanted 3 weeks of pre-production. So we tore songs apart, put them back together, tore this apart, put it like Bangle the Bells didn't even, the arrangement's totally different than we had originally. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because him sitting there, 8 hours, we'd go to work you know, 8 hours a day at a studio. And he would, you know, say, well, why don't you guys try a bridge here instead, or try this and that, you know what I mean? Or what if you put the pre-hook over here, or what if you sang this instead of that? He had a lot of ideas, you know. So when it came to Tom, we knew we were working with Tom Werman, right? So we practiced, man, you know, between albums, we practiced all the time on the new songs and just basically did everything that Simon Hanhart on our first album did with us. We did it ourselves. So by the time Tom Werman came down, he said, okay, let's book 2 weeks of pre-production. He came down, and the second day he came down, he goes, man, I don't even know what I'm doing here. You guys, there is no pre-production to do. All the arrangements are like where they're supposed to be. Everything seems, I don't know even know what we could change. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And I think he was, you know, because we, by that time, we kind of honed our craft a little bit more, you know?
Yeah.
We're kind of like veterans. After 4 years of just playing all the time, you know, you just naturally get better, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So I have one final question before I leave you go. And this is a little bit off the wall question. There was a series of shows in London, I think in 91 or 92, called the American Dream Series. And I remember Shadow King played a show there. That was Lou Graham and Vivian Campbell's band. Bang Tango played the show at it. XYZ played a show at it. I seem to recall ye guys being booked to do it. I think it was in London, and they flew these bands over from America to play a show. Were you guys ever contacted about that?
I think we were. I do remember something about that. I don't know why it fell through. I remember we were supposed to be on an Alice Cooper tour. We were supposed to be on an Aerosmith tour. Things that, and I'm talking things that fell apart like 3 days before.
Oh, God. You know? Oh, man.
Yeah. That's another thing about the business part. Like, what? Who? How did this get fucked up? That kind of thing. Because you're already practicing for it. You're doing your sets. You're getting ready for it. You know, yeah. And all of a sudden, phone call. Oh, well, that's not going to happen. Well, why? Well, some lame excuse, whatever it may be. You know what I mean? But back then, it was like, all right, well, fuck it. Just go out on the road on our own. Whatever we got to do.
Did you do arenas with anybody?
No, not really. No. I mean, we played some arenas that were like festivals and things like that. You know, but I would say for a good 2.5 years, 3.5 years, all we did was play large clubs or like size whiskey clubs that all across the United States. And we headlined every single one of them. You know, we didn't open up for anybody unless it was like a festival. I remember playing with like Warren a few times and Faith No More and basically anybody that was around, but they were always festivals. We played the Arizona Fest and things like that, you know, where you'd play for like 25,000-50,000 people and you're like, wow, this is great, you know.
Yeah, but then the next you would have seen all these bands that came out around the same time as you. You're on a major label. And they're getting all these arena shows. They might be opening for someone else, but they're playing arenas and you're not. You guys must have been pulling your hair out saying, how the fuck are they getting to do this and we're not?
Well, yeah. Yeah, of course we were. But at the same time, it would be, like I said, we had the Alice Cooper tour. Supposedly, it was already contracted. The Aerosmith tour, you know. And then you'd find out, whatever, I don't know, Aerosmith or Alice didn't go out because he was sick or something like that. You know, so it was crazy. We had William Morris Agency booking us, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they're one of the agencies in the world, you know. We had a lot of fun though, man, playing all the clubs and stuff and meeting all the people, you know what I mean? So I don't begrudge that in any way. Sure, it'd be fun to play in a gigantic stage with, you know, all these, you know, 20,000 people of whatever, be playing with Rat and they got 20,000 people and, you know, and we're playing before them. That would have been cool, you know.
Yeah,
but you know, so what? It didn't happen like that. I thought that would be just as good.
Did you end up playing in Japan at all?
Nope, never been to Japan. Been to Europe quite a bit, Germany, places like that, Canada a lot. We even played around in Mexico a couple times, which is kind of weird. But stayed around the United States, you know. Just, and we took some bands out with us, Cat and Boots, that came with us one time.
I remember that name.
Yeah, and then we took a couple other bands out. Where the hell was it? Shit, I can't remember. We played with Bang Tango a few times.
Okay.
I'm trying to think. What the hell am I trying to think about? Some bands that we'd like we already had our first album out, and then we went on a couple of tours where some bands put their first album out, so they toured with us, you know.
Yeah.
Wild Side. Yeah, I remember there was a band called Wild Side.
Yeah, I remember them.
Yeah, I can't remember the other bands, but yeah, it was kind of like that, and it was fun. And it still is, man. You know, I look at this like, you know, I don't know if you golf, but I love golfing. It's kind of like going to a gig is like golfing for me. You know, it's like the best hobby in the world, man. You know, it's just fun.
And the most frustrating.
Yeah. You're right, man.
So, Derek, what's happening for the rest of the year when it comes to gigs with the band? Do you have many shows lined up?
Yeah, we've got a lot of shows lined up. We're doing Denver, Salt Lake City. We're playing Monsters on the Mountain in Tennessee. Yeah, we're playing. We're doing some stuff in Florida, doing some stuff in Texas. So there's going to be I wouldn't say it's, but you know, it's not like back in the day where you play every single night. It's more like Weekend Warrior stuff. You know what I mean? And that's what you want to do, is because, you know, you don't want to get in a truck and drive around the United States. You know, it's not as fun as it once was. You know what I mean? But so, you do like to fly in, do a gig, and you know, have everything out there set up for you. That's pretty convenient.
So if I could go back to 88 now, and if I said this to you in 88. That you'd still be playing Babylon AD music in 2024, would you have said it was fucking crazy?
I would, you know, I would think you're kind of crazy, but at the same time, you know, I just can't believe the Rolling Stones and Aerosmith are still doing it.
Yeah.
Well, they could do it, I could keep going.
Yeah.
I mean, they're basic standard bearers, right? And how the hell could the Stones keep doing it?
I know. Like,
keep doing it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So yeah, we're just we just had our first two singles just came out. You know, Wrecking Machine came out about 2 months ago, and that did really well at radio. It's still doing really well at radio. And then we had our second single, Rome Wasn't Built in a Day, that came out about 2 weeks ago, and that's doing really well at radio. And you know, our video is doing pretty good. You know, we're trying to promote as best as we can, man. We got another. We have another single that's going to be coming out maybe 6 to 8 weeks from now, you know,
okay.
See what happens. We're just having a lot of fun, you know?
Nice. Well, I'm glad that you're still making music. This is what I love about doing the show, because I get to speak to people that I've been a fan of for many, many years. And I get a chance to talk to them about the new stuff, and I get a chance to pick their brain about the old stuff.
Yeah.
So that's what I really enjoy doing it. So where can people get in touch with the band and look at the tour dates and maybe pick up a copy of the record?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can pick up a copy of the record anywhere on the internet just by pressing a button saying Babylon AD's June, Rome was okay. But, you know, if anybody wants to get a hold of us for some reason, of course, Facebook is everywhere. Instagram, we're everywhere. And BabylonADBand.com, you know, we have our, you know, website, but, and, you know, we have our YouTube site and all that other kind of stuff, which we just started, by the way. We never had one. You know, it's like, hey, we got to start a YouTube website. And we're like, we do? You know, so there's a lot of parts of the business that we're kind of like, yeah, I guess we better get on board with everybody else. You know what I mean?
Whoa, I'm terrible at doing this. I have one final question for you. And I had this written down, and then I'll leave you go. What's the one decision management made for you back then that you scratch your head at now and go, what the fuck were they thinking?
That's kind of a hard one, because we had a lot of say with our management team, but there was a song called Psychedelic Sex Reaction on our second album that Clive thought was really, really a great song. And management, without telling us, told them, yes, the band loves this song. We hated the friggin' song. And out of a friggin' single, and they invited, without telling us, they told us the same damn day. We played a gig in Chicago, and they told us the same damn day. We got these boxes with condoms in them and all this stuff, how to have sex psychedelic wise. What is this shit? Well, this is going to radio tomorrow. And we flew in, like, you know, all the major radio stations from all over America. There's like 50 radio programmers here tonight. We're like, what? The band never played that song. Never. We only recorded it. But we never played it because we hated it. We thought it was corny. You know, we thought it was just a corny song. Psychedelic Sex Reaction. Although lots of people love that song, we just thought it was like, this song, to us, we were like, this song's like a Poison song or a Warrant song. This is too happy for us. That's what we were thinking, right? So then our management goes, you guys got to play that song. And so all of us went in the back of the bus, and I'll never forget, man, about half hour before the show. And we had vowed never to play that song as a band when we recorded. You know, we're never going to play the song. It's the stupidest song ever, you know, but they basically made us fucking record the song. Clive Davis said, if you don't play that song, or if you don't put this song on the record, then you're going to have to, you know, your record might not come out. He told me that on the phone. He called me up and talked to me about it because I didn't want to do it. And I said, fuck it. So we're going to do the song. Anyways, long story short, we're backstage. We put our hands in a pot. We said, we're not going to play the song no matter what. And we all look at each other like, this could be your death decision, right? Because the record company just flew out like, shit, 40, 45 freaking radio programmers, you know? So we get on stage, we kick ass, we do two encores, and we go back to the bus, and my manager comes on screaming on the bus, get back up there right now. You guys got to play Psychedelic Sex Reaction. That's why they're here. You guys got to play that song. You got to do it. And you know, we did. We looked at him. We said, fuck you, Jay. We ain't playing that song. I got to tell you, he's from New York. And, he was literally like a freaking cartoon character jumping up and hitting his head on the bus. You guys don't understand. You guys are going to ruin your career. I'm playing a fucking game. You don't know how much money they spent flying these people out. We're like, well, we told you we were never going to play that fucking song. You should. We tried to tell you. You wouldn't listen to us, you know. So moral of the story is you better do what they say, because literally we were always traveling in a really cool bus and everything. Like 2 weeks later, we were in a fucking Winnebago. Swear to God, man, they pulled all the tour support. They said, "Fuck you guys! If you don't want to, you know, do what we say, then we're not going to help you guys anymore." And literally, I think maybe 3 months later, they pulled our record deal.
Oh man!
I said, these guys are old, man. They don't listen to what. Yeah. All because we wouldn't play that friggin' song.
And you still haven't played it, have you?
No, fuck no. I hate that. And the funny thing is, some people like that. What? This is corny, man.
All right, Derek, I'm going to leave you go. That was a great story. All right.
When's the other?
Yeah, if you ever get up my way, I'm in Lowell, Massachusetts. I'll hit you up and get to say hello to you. All right, take care.
And there you go. There is Richie's chat with Derek Davis of Babylon AD. And as Derek mentioned, as I mentioned way at the beginning, they've got new stuff out. Rome Wasn't Built in a Day. And as Derek said as well, that you can pick that up pretty much anywhere that you would normally get any of your new music. So go out there, support Babylon AD. As Derek also mentioned, the new single, Rome Wasn't Built in a Day, is available to watch up on YouTube. You can go to their YouTube channel as well. If you want to, follow them over there on the interwebs, you can go to BabylonADBand.com. From there, they've got a merch store. I think right now they've got maybe a couple t-shirts. They've got some digital downloads available up there. All their social links are also available from there. So quick, easy to navigate site. And again, that is BabylonADBand.com. You can even kind of do a try before you buy up there with the new album, because they do have clips of, I think, almost every single song available on their download section. So hear a clip, decide whether you like it or not, and then, you know, either get the physical, get the digital, but they have made it pretty damn easy for you to decide if you want to grab some new Babylon AD music or not. So again, thanks to Derek for taking a shit ton of time with Richie this week, and not only talking about the new album, but also giving us a lot of Babylon AD history as well. Some good stories there, like I said before. I mean, how many times do you get to hear a Clive Davis jumping up saying, boys, I'm going to make you stars kind of story on a podcast? But there you go. We able to notch that one off of our bucket list this week, courtesy of Derek Davis. And also another gentle reminder before we head off into the sunset for the week, but if you haven't already ordered yourself a copy of Brian Heaton's new Queensryche epic touring tome called Roads to Madness, the touring history of Queensryche, 1981 to 1997. You should go and pick yourself up a copy of that. It is a worthy read. Lots of incredible Queensryche tour information in that one. Anyways, for this week, that's it. There ain't no more stick a fork in it. This puppy is done. So for Richie, myself, and everybody else here at Focus on Metal, have yourselves a great metal week. And until we talk to you again next time, as always, remember...
Focus on Metal!
Everything else is insignificant.
Still here? It's over. Go home.